Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, as Major League Baseball has now officially recognized Negro League statistics, we'll discuss a lesser-known story about integration in America's pastime. Some residents in the Metro East near St. Louis are still trying to get compensated for exposure to radiation. We'll learn more. And we'll also hear about an investigation into homeschooling in Illinois. When a drunk driver struck a woman's house in Peoria, the homeowner was shocked. Then she got the bill from the city. We'll have her story. We'll also visit the National Music Museum. It's located in an unlikely setting. And in honor of National Pollinators Week, we find out about efforts to help butterflies. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A months-long investigation into homeschooling in Illinois finds several problems. Jennifer Fuller has more on that story.
The investigation from Capital News Illinois and ProPublica details cases of educational neglect, where kids are kept from going to school, putting vulnerable children at risk of not getting an education or of abuse and neglect. Illinois, reporters found, has few rules when it comes to homeschooling. Parents can keep their children home for any reason, and the state doesn't require standardized testing or checkups to make sure kids stay on track with their studies. While many homeschool families follow online or other curricula, some vulnerable children receive no education. In extreme cases, abuse and neglect are found.
It's sad. There are heartbreaking stories that, you know, where kids are being denied schooling because their parents are irresponsible and they don't want the accountability of getting them dressed, getting them to school.
Kyle Thompson is the regional superintendent of schools for an area covering parts of East Central Illinois. Regional school superintendents are tasked with tracking truancy and working with families to get children back into the classroom. But once a family says the student is homeschooled, the superintendents have no more jurisdiction. Sometimes, Thompson says, families will ask for help with homeschooling, but options from the Regional Office of Education are limited.
You wouldn't believe how many people say, hey, I'm homeschooling, what can you give me? And, like, I have that conversation a few times a year. I'm like, nothing. Like, this is on you. We're giving you the public schools. Like, you know, if you don't want to do that, then it's on you.
Child welfare advocates say some cases they see are troubling. Children who are abused or neglected but rarely see anyone outside their home are falling through the safety nets created to protect them. The regional offices of education typically have staff who do home visits, mainly to investigate reports of truancy. But John Cox and Jeff Bink, truancy interventionists with the ROE based in downstate Marion, say that's not always the answer to the problem.
We will go out and do a home visit on them and see why they're not registered at school, try to figure out, break down the barriers of, are they going to enroll or are they doing homeschool? And most of them that we get when we go there, they say we are homeschooling our kids. And that's a lot of the reports that you get. It's concerned citizens that see kids running around outside the house and they're like, how come this kid's not in school? So we go out there and then they tell us that they're homeschooling. Of course, in the state of Illinois, they don't have to register for homeschooling. So once they give that verbal, it's pretty much out of our hands.
Reporters in this investigation highlighted one case where a child in Rock Island died after accidentally shooting himself in December of 2022. His mother then hid the body, telling a friend she didn't want her other children to be taken away. And since he was homeschooled, quote, nobody knows. He's not in school. 7 months passed before police found his body in a trash can in the garage. His mom, Sushi Staples, originally faced charges of concealing a death, failure to report the death of a child within 24 hours, and obstructing justice. Staples pleaded guilty to felony endangering the health of a child, and in April, she was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Illinois' Department of Children and Family Services is the agency obligated to investigate reports of abuse and neglect, but it does not investigate schooling matters. The General Assembly removed that authority from them in 1990 and gave it to the regional offices of education. But many, like Superintendent Matthew Hickam in far southwestern Illinois, say they don't know what to do either.
homeschooling can certainly work well. Some people do it extremely well, but yeah, there needs to be some kind of layer of accountability that's possible so that it isn't so easy for kids to slip through the cracks. I don't know what the legislative answer is. It seems like, just in my brief amount of time, that there just seems to be a lot of powerful interest groups that are preventing or put up the roadblocks to keep anything from going through at the state level.
Efforts to pass legislation updating regulations on homeschooling face stiff opposition. Homeschool groups organize large lobbying efforts to defeat the bills they oppose. They believe it's the parents' right to decide how to educate their children without state interference. Kirk Smith is with Illinois Christian Home Educators.
All we want is to be left alone, and Illinois has been so good. We have probably the best state in the nation to homeschool. They recognize our numbers are very successful.
Smith goes on to say students affiliated with his organization do well academically, too.
The government here has been so good to recognize that and to say, let's leave these folks alone and do what they do because they're being successful for it.
Statistics show in 2022, the number of children withdrawn from traditional schools in favor of homeschooling in Illinois was double what it was 10 years before. And experts say that's likely an undercount. Parents are not required to tell their local school district that they're keeping their children home. Education leaders, along with child welfare advocates, say they're continuing to work on ways to protect children while maintaining parents' rights in Illinois. I'm Jennifer Fuller, Capital News, Illinois.
Major League Baseball recently made news when it announced it would recognize Negro League statistics. The move, while controversial among some, also recognized players who never got the chance to play in the majors. Larry Doby was a Negro League player, but he got the chance. Still, despite breaking the color barrier in the American League, just months after Jackie Robinson did the same in the National League, Doby is much less known, yet he faced much of the same abuse and threats Robinson did. He's just one story in the book A Calculus of Color, The Integration of Baseball's American League. Author Robert McGregor, a former professor at the University of Illinois Springfield, spoke with me previously, and here's that conversation.
The basic problem was that there was a series of books on the history of the Negro Leagues, many of them very much romanticized, and then there was the history of Major League Baseball and what was called the Golden Age, which was the late 40s through about 1960. But there was nothing that really tied together the history of integration with the history of the Negro Leagues or really addressed the issue of race. And so I put that together.
You focus on the American League primarily here. Most of what people know about integration of baseball comes from Jackie Robinson and, of course, the Brooklyn Dodgers and Branch Rickey. The American League and the players who broke the color barrier there, including Larry Doby, the first one to do so, always seemed to me to be a bit more of a footnote in history. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the reasons I chose to do the American League. The story always was the National League was far more aggressive in signing black players than the American League, and I wanted to know why. And so I decided that it would be a much more effective way of treating the larger issue of race in American history if I looked at people who were more reluctant. And so that's why I ended up doing the American League.
The last team to integrate came from an area that people would not expect, and that was Boston.
Boston was the only major city that did not have a Negro League team. The black population of Boston was comparatively small compared to the other northeastern cities. But what most people really don't know is that Boston could have been the first. They tried out Jackie Robinson before he signed with Branch Rickey. It was kind of a farce, to be honest with you, what they did. But they could have been the first. But supposedly the owner, Tom Yawkey, didn't want to be first, and he certainly succeeded. He was last.
What really came as a surprise to you?
Well, what struck me more than anything else was, that the American League, they were the upstart league. They started out in 1901, and they wanted to address problems that had come into organized baseball. The National League had become very complacent, and the game was getting very ugly, to be honest with you. And they wanted to create a more family kind of atmosphere, and so they were kind of rebels. They wanted to make changes, and they succeeded in doing so. And then, of course, You know, in the 1920s, when the great change in baseball took place with Babe Ruth, and they were at the forefront of that. So you could, for the first 50 years or so, the American League was by far the more pioneering league. But by the late 40s, early 50s, they'd become very reactionary because a lot of the guys who had done all that rebelling all those years ago, they were still there. Now they had become very conservative and very reluctant to make any changes at all.
Well, this was such an advance for African Americans, not just in baseball, but in society, to see this color line broken. It also meant the demise of what had been a pretty successful black-run institution, the Negro Leagues.
Yes, very much so. One of the issues that black people such as Dubois and others who were trying to promote black culture and black economics, said that in order for blacks to succeed, they had to establish their own enterprises, and the Negro Leagues were far and away the most successful of those enterprises. But the problem was that during the 1930s, during the Depression, there was so little money around that most of the Negro League teams ended up being owned by racketeers. And so when it came time for integration to begin, Branch Rickey, when he signed Jackie Robinson, refused to give any money to the Kansas City Monarchs, saying that, that they weren't really a business enterprise, they were a racket. And, that set a very nasty precedent, which I'm at least happy to say that Bill Veeck, who was the first one to pioneer integration in the American League, he set a different precedent. He paid the Newark Eagles for Larry Doby. It wasn't as much probably as he was worth, but at least they got something.
It's safe to say that racism, maybe not quite as blatantly, still exists in the professional sports world and certainly in baseball?
It's a kind of issue that's never apparently going to go away. I always told my students when I was teaching that you can't understand American history unless you at least try to understand race. It's just an essential part of who we are, and it's just something that's not going to go away. And it's also a much more complicated thing than it appears. You think race and you think, well, skin color. But it's far more complicated than that because, there's a whole set of cultural assumptions that go with it. And, so today when you see, race problems, more often than not, it could be between the American black players and, the black Latino players as much as between, whites and blacks. So, it's a far more complicated thing, and it was from the very beginning. One of my favorite examples, in the early days of the Cleveland Indians, after they had integrated, they had two young players. One was Minnie Minoso, who, of course, became very famous with the White Sox, and the other was Harry Simpson. Simpson was from Georgia. Minoso was from Cuba. And basically, Harry Simpson told Minnie Minoso that he was not black, which certainly surprised Minoso. And Minoso pointed out that he was subject to the same kinds of, discrimination that Simpson was subject to. But Simpson said, no, you're not black because you're not an American black. You have not had our experiences. It's different for you. So it's a far more complicated kind of thing than what you might expect.
Let me ask, when it comes to the players in the American League that broke the color line, maybe in some cases, maybe there was one player or just a couple of players on some of these American League teams. Did they face the same type of abuse that Jackie Robinson did, or had that waned a bit because Robinson had already crossed that line?
Not really. I mean, Larry Doby was very much the subject of the same kinds of abuse, and it really affected him. In his autobiography, Bill Veeck talks about how he kind of wished that Larry Doby had not been the first, not because he wasn't a great player, but he could have been a much better player if he'd been just a little bit later when some of the abuse had kind of died away, because it really did affect him very much so. And then when subsequent teams began to organize, that they all had the same kinds of problems. I mean, Pumpsy Green was the last player to integrate with the Red Sox, and he said that, I never felt comfortable in the entire time that I was there. I was always, subject to that extra scrutiny.
And that was, what, about a dozen years after Robinson had already started with the Dodgers, right?
Yeah, it was 1959. The rest of the Red Sox, you know, they were kind of cool, except for Ted Williams. I mean, God bless Ted Williams. I mean, he was the one player who said, you know, if you, come on, kid, we'll play catch. You know, you're going to be my guy. And Williams really helped Green. But the rest of the players were pretty much indifferent, and there was a lot of hostility in a lot of locker rooms.
Baseball gets lauded quite often by historians when they look back because of Jackie Robinson, because of the integration, saying that baseball was far ahead of society at that time and really sort of led the way. But when you look at the American League, when you look at also this slow process of integration that took place even after Robinson entered, is it deserving of those kudos that baseball often gets?
To some degree, I would say yes. You know, the early pioneers, Bill Veeck and Branch Rickey, I mean, they were very brave. You can divide it into three kind of mini eras, if you will. I mean, there's the first one, Dobie signs with Cleveland and Robinson signs with Dodgers. And that kind of came to a kind of a sad end in the American League because the second team to integrate was the St. Louis Browns, who did it for all the wrong reasons. They were just desperate because, you know, they were just losing money. It was just, you know, just leaking out from all the pores in the organization. And so they figured, well, we'll sign a couple of black guys, and so all the black people in St. Louis will come to see us. Well, they didn't do their homework. They signed two guys who really were not much help to them, and they only lasted 5 weeks, and they were gone. So it really set integration back quite a bit, you know, because, you know, at the end of 1947, Cleveland was the only team that had done it successfully in the American League. You know, you have a very slow, you know, kind of reaction to it. And then when the Civil Rights Movement really gets rolling in the mid-50s, that's when you see several American League teams capitulate. But they were more reacting to what was going on outside than, you know, doing it for, you know, for reasons integral to their own organization. And then the last two holdouts were Detroit and Boston. And, you know, I mean, they did it basically because they were forced to. They really had no choice.
That's Robert McGregor, author of A Calculus of Color, The Integration of Baseball's American League. There's more to come on Statewide.
This is Statewide.
We'll be right back. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll take you to the National Music Museum in an unlikely place. But first, it's National Pollinators Week. For the past 25 years, pollinator species have experienced a drop in numbers. Experts say that's due to habitat loss, chemical use, and climate change. Butterflies are a pollinator that capture people's attention and serve as a gateway into learning about preserving habitat. Anna Pope has more on how butterfly breeders and farms are helping in that effort.
A kaleidoscope of black and white striped butterflies surround plants in a quiet room on the Uchi Butterfly Farm in Leonard, Oklahoma.
These are zebra longwings, so they're most reliably found in southern Oklahoma, but every few years...
That's Jane Breckenridge. She has been raising butterflies here for 15 years, selling them to exhibitions and state fairs. But her work is also about preservation. The butterfly farm is on land that was allotted to her great-grandmother, who was Muskogee and Uchi. Breckenridge wants to help other Native people learn to farm butterflies and to educate about habitat conservation and cultural preservation.
So for me, I love butterflies, but it's more about how they can be ambassadors to engage people in this conversation that I think needs to happen so badly about how do we preserve ecosystems, how do we preserve wild spaces, how do we save the planet before it's too late.
The decline of pollinator populations has raised concern among scientists. For instance, the annual survey on monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico found a 59% drop in their numbers this year. Nicole Ault is the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Center of Pollinator Conservation.
You know, pollinator species in general, butterflies included, are declining, and the challenges across both bees, butterflies, and a lot of other pollinator species are very similar. Habitat loss over decades, as well as pesticide exposure, climate change, and disease.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service works with many groups, including the Uchi Butterfly Farm. The service helped provide funding to launch the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators, a nonprofit housed on the farm. Other organizations raising butterflies also hope to educate about pollinators. Ryan Malone is the owner of the Hatchery Butterfly Farm in Kansas, where he raises butterflies for events and exhibitions, and is the president of the International Butterfly Breeders Association. He's been busy making plant seed packets for people to raise butterfly-friendly plants.
If I do a butterfly release, I try to then educate people. I put like QR codes on things, like scan this and you'll learn more about the plants that will help this butterfly to have more. You know, it is definitely married together.
Just as butterflies rely on certain plants, like milkweed, flowers and gardens rely on butterflies for their pollination. Helping butterfly habitats helps other pollinators like bees. They're important to many crops, said Reed Johnson, an entomology professor at Ohio State University.
Well, the statistic that's usually mentioned is that a third of our food is made possible through insect or pollination from some other animal.
For instance, in Ohio, corn is pollinated through wind, while melons need insects' help.
And so a lot of the crop plants that we depend on for food really need some animal to move pollen from one flower to another in order for that plant to set fruit to produce the nuts or the fruit or the seeds that we want to eat.
Johnson says he encourages people to plant native flowering plants to support pollinator populations. He says even a small patch of plants that can be slowly incorporated makes a difference. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Anna Pope.
You can drive from one end of Chicago to the other and never see or even hear a cicada, but in certain pockets of the city where nature has persisted, they are loud and present. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco spoke with residents on the far south side and far north side of the city to see how they're coping with the overwhelming numbers of flying red-eyed insects.
Kimberly Henderson lives in a picturesque home on a tree-lined street in Beverly. Usually it's quiet. Then 2 weeks ago, the cicadas pushed and shoved their way out of the ground, and it got loud. Think surround sound blow dryer from all directions.
We've had cicadas before, but never this. And then one day it was like our house is under siege.
She shows me her garden. Her plants are covered in cicadas, maybe one on every other leaf. Her trees, crawling with them. Her lawn and garage, completely taken over. Her family has stopped using the front door altogether, surrendering it to the insects.
The bad part is my daughter has prom send-off this tonight. So we were frantic, like we can't do a send-off with cicadas everywhere.
We're going to do it here?
We are still going to do it here.
These aren't regular cicadas threatening to crash prom this year. These are periodical cicadas. They occur in 13 and 17-year cycles depending on the brood. This year is especially rare, because both types emerged at the same time for the first time in over 200 years. And there's a big bullseye on Illinois, where both broods emerge side by side. Henderson says her husband will use a leaf blower to get rid of the cicadas. But some birds have been helping too, by eating them.
The seagulls, they're just everywhere, and it starts at like 5 in the morning. They literally wake you up.
But they've been doing you a favor.
Absolutely, because they might have saved prom tonight.
The seagulls make Henderson laugh, because she doesn't even live near water. Her situation is rare. For the majority of the city, the cicadas everyone was waiting for never came. Scientists say that's because too many mature trees were sacrificed to urban development. Without old trees, there are no cicadas. So to track down the insect, I turned to TikTok, which sent me about 30 miles north of Henderson's home.
I created a barrier because there's so many cicadas right now, and I just don't want to leave my car, but I have to get to my house.
Okay, but just to pause there.
Yeah.
What are you wearing in this video?
I'm wearing a Whole Foods bag, brown paper bag.
That's Emmy Sneed. She lives in the Edgebrook neighborhood, right by suburban Skokie and Niles. We're watching a recent TikTok video she made. In it, she's just gotten home from work, and cicadas overwhelm her. She's crying, scared, and doesn't know what to do besides throw on a paper bag with a giant hole to keep them out of her face. The video went viral.
So likes, it has 1.3 million. I think views, it's like 14 million.
Cicadas are still crawling around her yard and house, but she says now they're mostly in the trees. just the right distance for her to be able to appreciate them.
Even though things are gross, things are also pretty incredible and kind of a miracle that something, you know, like a cicada can be buried for 17 years and then like it's crazy.
These cicadas live a very short life after emerging. Soon, the ones above ground will be dead.
So yeah, we only have a couple more weeks, hopefully.
And you're just counting down the days.
I truly am. Yeah, yep. I cannot wait.
They won't really be gone, though. In Edgebrook, like in Beverly, they'll still be here. Millions of them, living underground, biding their time, just waiting to crash another prom or go viral on the internet in another 17 years. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
The Illinois State Treasurer Mike Frericks is celebrating after sending $500,000 to someone who didn't know he had it coming. Frericks says the Lake County man, who doesn't want to be identified, received the payout through the state's iCash program from his late wife's life insurance policy. He wasn't even aware she had it. A recent change in state law now requires life insurance companies to cross-check their policies against federal death records to ensure they're making correct payouts. But Frericks says a lot of people don't know that, and they think iCash is a scam.
In the treasurer's office, and with the help of the General Assembly, we are returning record amounts of money. But we still have more to go. We have another $5 billion we'd love to return.
Frericks says his office has returned about $2 billion to people through the iCash program since he's been in office. Galena in far northwest Illinois has appointed its first poet laureate. Yvonne Booz finds out how the longtime creative wants to use poetry to bring the community together.
What do roses know of love?
That's Ted Williams reciting his poem, A Clanging Cymbal.
Posted from above, from all humbleness is strange.
This February, the city of Galena set out to find its first poet laureate. The task was completed a couple of months later. Larissa Distler is the adult service librarian at the Galena Public Library. She says the library wants the poet to engage the community.
And Ted had a lot of really great credentials with his business and working with the community with a lot of different committees and things that he's been involved in Galena. So it seemed just like a perfect fit.
Ted Williams owns the Haunted Galena Tour Company with his wife, Robin Davis. He's a playwright, tour guide, director, and producer, and most recently added title, Galena Poet Laureate. Williams started writing poetry about 30 years ago. He says he hasn't kept his writings. Instead, he gives them as gifts to those around him. One of the requirements of the Poet Laureate is to complete a legacy project. Williams is already planning on how to pull that together. The city's bicentennial is coming up in 2026. Williams' idea is to have the community write 200 pieces about Galena. Those poems will then be put in a celebratory book. He says he's almost done with the marketing pieces.
I will be visiting everybody from nursing homes to fire departments to restaurants to, you know, to the schools, everyone. And so we hope to get everyone involved. And with any luck, we'll have what we need here in about 6 months, if we're lucky.
Williams says when he was first made aware of the position, he didn't think he had time to do it. He says, against his better judgment, he decided to put his name in the hat.
I was really lucky. People really came in and supported me on it. I was a little surprised. It gets me emotional that how much everybody just went, oh, that's you, you know? So I'm like, oh, all right, that's good. So, and Robin, my wife, was 100% behind it too.
William says poetry is the focal point of all of his creative endeavors. He plays the guitar, writes songs, and shares that his plays are saturated with poetry. Williams calls poetry the jazz of literature.
It's hard sometimes to write things down in just prose or in words, but poetry can transcend that, and it has the ability to transmit emotion and feeling and perspective that you can't always get with just traditional writing.
Williams says he wants to get more people to not only write, but share their works.
My goal is to get people to bravely come forward and say, you know what? I've written some poetry and I think it's pretty great. And it says something about me. There's no wrong answer. And here's mine, you know, and if we can do that, we're gonna break open some real gems.
He says there are divisions in the city. He wants to erase those lines. One split is the way residents feel about the city's attraction to tourists. William says some are excited about the economic benefits it brings.
Other folks feel that our small town way of life is threatened by it. You know, so the fact of the matter is, I think all of these things can be brought together if we stop focusing on little micro niches of our own needs.
I'm Yvonne Booth.
Never to bow stubborn blooms, nor mourn by crestfallen tear, floral harbingers of doom intensify latent fears.
The National Music Museum is one of the world's largest and most significant collections of historical instruments, sort of like a musical Smithsonian. But it's far away from the museums on the National Mall. It's in Vermilion, South Dakota. Elizabeth Rimbert tells us how the museum ended up there and how many treasures it holds.
During a tour at the National Music Museum, conservator Daryl Martin walks up to one instrument, a small wooden keyboard painted in olive green.
This is actually the oldest playable harpsichord in the world.
With a bit of pleading, he demonstrates what the world's oldest harpsichord sounds like. This harpsichord was probably made in Naples around 1525. 500 years later, it's here, in Vermilion, South Dakota, a town of just under 12,000, tucked into the state's southeastern tail.
Why the National Music Museum is in Vermilion, South Dakota is probably our most asked question.
That's museum director Dwight Vaught. He says the story all starts when a man named Arnie Larson came to town with his 2,500 instruments. It was 1966, and the university in Vermilion had hired Larson as a music professor. The new recruit came with a catch.
When he was hired by the University of South Dakota, he said, "Do you have a place that I can store my instruments?" And so they offered him a space.
Then Arnie's son Andre led the charge to turn the storage space into a museum. He was the first director when the museum officially opened its doors in 1973.
Both Arnie and his son Andre were true forces of nature. When you have that visionary mindset, you can sort of block out any of the potential questions or criticisms that might come your way.
Andre really put the museum on the map in 1984 when he coordinated a $3 million donation to purchase a prestigious collection of Italian strings that included the world's oldest cello. The acquisition brought the museum global attention and confusion.
And all of a sudden then, that did catapult us into people literally around the world saying, wait a minute, what's this National Music Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota?
50 years after its founding, the museum boasts a collection of 14,000 instruments, like a soprano saxophone made by Adolph Sax, who invented the instrument in the 1840s. Or a grand piano built in 1901 that was once the largest piano ever made. Conservator Daryl Martin, our reluctant harpsichord player, says the collection boasts everything from a 16th century violin to an electric guitar just 20 years old. He says that variety makes it top three in the world.
So it's the quality of the instruments over a wide range of instrument types.
On the first floor, a group is congregating in one of the exhibit rooms. It's a big space that only holds one instrument, an Indonesian gamelan. The orchestra's percussion instruments stretch across the room. The group is ignoring any do not touch signs to move the ornate gongs, drums, pots, and xylophones that sit across the room. The Vermilion locals aren't here to admire the instruments. They're here to play them. Faith Weber plays the Peking, which sort of looks like a small xylophone. After practice, she says she served in the Navy and had learned about gamelan during her time in Asia. When she heard about a gamelan concert in Vermilion, she thought a traveling group was coming through town.
So I came and I was just stunned to find out that instruments lived here.
She's been playing the National Music Museum's gamelan for the past 10 years. She says the entire museum is an unlikely gem for Vermilion.
This is one of the best sets of instruments in the world, and it's here in South Dakota. We're so lucky.
After all, as Arne Larsen famously said, it's just as far from New York to Vermilion as it is from Vermilion to New York. I'm Elizabeth Rembert, Harvest Public Media.
You're tuned in to Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A number of Midwestern state legislatures, including Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, and others, have introduced bills this year that could give rights to embryos and fetuses. None of those passed, but they're expected to come up in the future. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs reports some Midwesterners worry about how it could affect their reproductive choices.
Jacqueline Brock endured grueling fertility treatment for 7 years and all of the emotion that came with it.
I had to stop going to outings with our friends because they would bring their kids or talk about their kids and I would just cry. I didn't go to a lot of baby showers and things because I couldn't physically handle it.
Brock and her husband James live in West Des Moines, Iowa. Last year, she underwent a third round of in vitro fertilization, or IVF. It produced 2 embryos. She had 1 implanted. This time it worked.
I got a call from our fertility clinic and all of the nurses and our doctors, I'm gonna start crying. They were on the phone and they all yelled out we were pregnant.
Brock's daughter Eloise was born in January. But her joy quickly turned to frustration when, a month later, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that embryos created through IVF should be considered children.
And I remember I just started crying and I was so angry.
Brock says she felt for the women who had to pause their IVF cycles during the initial confusion in the wake of the ruling. But it also made her concerned about the couple's remaining embryo. They really want a second child. At the time, several Midwestern states, including Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, were considering bills that could impact families seeking IVF. The bills could give some rights to embryos that are generally ascribed to a person. Doctors told Brock she likely can't use the embryo to carry another pregnancy herself for medical reasons, so she and her husband are considering other options like surrogacy. But the precarious legal landscape worries them a lot.
We were talking about, do we need to get a lawyer to figure out what to do with our embryo? Or do we need to move our embryo to another state so that it's safe?
It's common practice during IVF to create extra embryos in case of abnormalities or other issues. And embryos can be easily damaged, as they were in the case central to the Alabama decision. Infertility specialist Abby Mancuso says when embryos are legally considered children, that could have a detrimental impact on doctors like her.
If you're an embryologist or an institution and you could be held criminally liable for any damage that occurred to these microscopic cells, you know, that's obviously a concern.
Facilities also may face civil liability and be sued for a lot of money and damages. Debates over abortion and IVF protections are expected to play a significant role in the upcoming election. Proponents of bills that define life as beginning at conception say they want to ensure they are written so they protect IVF and fertility treatments. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed a law shielding IVF patients and providers from legal liability following the Alabama court decision. But critics say it's not that easy. Sarah Wilson is an attorney who specializes in fertility and adoption practices.
It's hard to really write in exceptions that are truly going to protect families and IVF and other fertility treatments while still keeping the position that an embryo is a person.
Wilson says in the meantime, it's added more stress for her clients who are already going through a difficult, complicated process. It's changed their tone.
Instead of the hope and excitement that I usually hear from them, they come to me with concern and they're scared. They are not sure if their legal parentage will be protected and if they'll have decisions over their own medical care.
Wilson says some of her clients are nervous about what the future might hold and are talking about pursuing fertility treatment out of state. Natalie Krebs, Side Effects Public Media.
That story is a collaboration among Iowa Public Radio, Side Effects Public Media, and the Midwest Newsroom. Illinois lawmakers have passed a bill expanding access to fentanyl testing strips. It's an effort to combat opioid-related overdoses. Mawa Iqbal has that report.
The bill is just one signature from the governor away from becoming law. It would direct the State Department of Human Services to create a grant program for health facilities to distribute testing strips, which test other drugs for traces of fentanyl. Harold Pollack is a public health researcher at the University of Chicago, and he says bills like this are needed.
Our society has such a tenuous commitment to the well-being of people who use drugs that when I see things like the fentanyl test strip law and other things that they're doing, I find it very heartening.
Pollack says it's also important to make it easier for people to access medication used to treat opioid addiction, like methadone. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
The American Heart Association is bringing attention to a new national poll projecting 61% of American adults will develop cardiovascular disease by 2050. That's up from about half of adults currently. The study primarily attributes the surge to cost barriers that prevent healthy eating. CEO Nancy Brown wants to break those barriers.
The association is putting unprecedented emphasis on several things, including improving our understanding of the food we eat, integrating nutritious foods into healthcare, and ensuring that healthy food is available and affordable for all.
In response to the findings, the Heart Association plans to release a patient registry for people living with obesity. The registry wants to provide researchers with a better understanding of the causes and potential treatments. While the work to get Missouri residents compensated for radiation exposure has gotten lots of attention, an effort to help victims in the Metro East in Illinois has largely gone unnoticed. Will Bauer has more.
In the push to get compensation in these Metro East communities, there's two men who've made it their life's work. First is Larry Bergen, whose former attorney described his arms as looking like they've had dried concrete spread across them. He pulls a picture out of a binder.
This is what I looked like when the company got rid of me. I was covered with radiation burns.
Bergen and a handful of other former employees of a Venice factory gather in Granite City every couple of months. Here, they receive some basic medical care and talk through options to seek government funding. These men and women worked at a site once owned by the Dow Chemical Company in the mid-50s and 60s. Just like in Missouri, Dow contracted with Mallinckrodt Chemical Works to process uranium for the Atomic Energy Commission. Many here in Granite City didn't work in the factory when Dow owned it, like Bergen, but the radiation stuck around.
This is the largest radioactive waste site in the state of Illinois, and no one knows it.
Some of Bergen's fellow employees are eligible to receive funding through a program similar to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. But there's a caveat. That program is just for workers. So far, it's paid out more than $31 million for 170 workers at the site in Venice. At another facility just north in Granite City, more than $33 million has been doled out. But what about the residents? An informal survey done by community members found nearly 370 cases of cancer in the blocks around the factory in Venice and nearby Madison. Another man who's made compensation his life's work is Calvin Ratliff. He not only worked at the factory, but he grew up right next to it, separated by a couple hundred feet and a fence. Ratliff says the cancer cases in the community are similar to the cases in former workers.
Well, these certain cancers were identical to a lot of the cancers that the people in the community have. Now, why would a fence make a difference?
No government agency appears to have documented the cancer rates in the area. Bergen and Ratliff believe that number would likely be higher if there was ever an official tally done. U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, the Democrat whose district includes the area, said she'd like to expand RECA to include one zip code that spans parts of Venice, Madison, and Granite City.
You know, the history of these communities and how that history still impacts their present day and their futures, we need to make sure that they're properly compensated so they can get back up on their feet.
If passed with an Illinois zip code, these Metro East residents could get a one-time $50,000 payment. Ratliff actually had cancer back in 2017, but his tests didn't meet the threshold under the workers' program. While he's on the mend now, he says it's frustrating. And like Ratliff, Bergen hasn't qualified either. He's never gotten cancer.
For some reason, I've been blessed because perhaps helping everybody else has been my reward not to develop a cancer. I like to think that. But at the same time, I'm realistic. It's only a matter of time because of where I worked and how long and what it was supposed to.
Congress missed its deadline to pass an expansion of RECA as a standalone bill. But Budzinski and the Missouri delegation are hopeful they can add an amendment to the annual defense spending bill that is currently up for debate. In the meantime, Bergen and Ratliff say they will keep advocating. The longtime mayor of Venice, Tyrone Eccles, says the federal government has an opportunity to build trust by expanding RECA to these communities.
It's amazing thinking about governmental entities and some of the things that they did in times of war. And some of it may be understandable, I guess. Your back's against the wall, you do what you got to do and suffer with the effects afterwards. But they should be aware that they're responsible. Step up to the plate and do the right thing. Yeah.
For now, they've put the ball in Congress's court. I'm Will Bauer.
That story, a partnership with the Belleville News Democrat, Kelly Smits, contributed to that report. A drunk driver crashed into a Peoria woman's house. That was a shock, but then the homeowner got the bill, WCBU's Colin Shope reports.
On the evening of Saturday, August 13th, 2022, a red Ford F-150 careened across a yard and crashed into a home after crashing into another vehicle and veering off the roadway in the 400 block of East Republic Street in Peoria. Police reports show the driver called the vehicle in as stolen shortly after, but an investigation would find her later admitting to operating the truck with a blood alcohol content of 0.179. Jamisha Hudson lives in the house this truck crashed into.
I thought it was a prank at first, and they were just like, yeah, somebody hit your house. And I was like, there's no way possible. Like, I think you may have the wrong house because I'm in the middle of this block.
Hudson had been out to dinner with her daughter and a friend when the crash happened. She says she sped up just a bit on the way home, anticipating the extent of the damage. Then she saw the porch.
When I pulled up, I just broke down. I started crying. I was screaming because I was like, what the heck? You know, I didn't know the damage to the inside of the house. All I saw was just the porch completely collapsed.
Later, reflecting on the night, Hudson is grateful she'd chosen to go out. She says she and her daughter frequently sat in the front room of the house during the evenings.
When the porch fell down, they broke our window. So we could have been sitting right here. Everything could have collapsed, and it could have just been this really traumatizing event for my daughter specifically.
Shortly after, the city of Peoria performed an inspection of the damage. Community Development Director Joe Doolin says this is standard anytime there's an incident like a house fire or a car crash.
And if we feel the kind of structural stability poses a risk to the public, then we have a few different course of actions. You know, when it's to an entire structure, we sometimes do an emergency demolition, but we try to save as much of the structure as possible.
In the case of Hudson's home, this meant an emergency demolition of what remained of the porch overhang. Today, you can still see the stripped wood from where the top of the porch connected to the house. Doolin says decisions like these are made in the name of safety.
Really, it's about minimizing the danger that the public may face if they come into contact that or if it collapses any further.
What followed for Hudson was a bill from the city, viewed by WCBU. The bill, with an invoice date of November 2022, shows a total of nearly $3,670 for the demolition. Hudson says she's a single mother, and prioritizing bills for necessities meant she didn't have home insurance at the time.
I didn't realize how much of a priority it was because I was like, well, I got to pay, you know, my electric, my water. I have to pay all these other things. And now I have it because I'm like, oh, shoot, I'll never go through that again. But I mean, it's kind of a little too late. One of those lessons you had to learn the hard way.
Doolin explains that in the case of using a contractor for an emergency demolition like this, it is the standard for the bill to go to the property owner.
That's where they go through their homeowner's insurance, or sometimes it's a civil matter between who caused the dispute to find who's ultimately responsible for the bill. But as far as we're concerned, you know, with where the damage was done and to the property where the work occurred is where we submit the bill to start with.
Hudson reached out to a few different places for help. She contacted the Peoria Citizens Committee for Economic Opportunity. She reached out to her city council representative. She explored neighborhood redevelopment programs through the city. These programs were either too broad or too limited to assist in her very specific situation. 3rd District Council Representative Tim Riggenbach was contacted by WCBU for this story, and he referred back to community development. Hudson explored legal action against the drunk driver with private attorneys, but isn't sure the driver has any income of their own. In the meantime, fees have piled on the bill.
They've sent us multiple bills regarding the situation instead of just sending it. And I understand it's like the city, but send it to her. Like, she's the one that did it. Like, I don't understand why it's my responsibility, but I guess I'm the homeowner, so I understand that.
A more recent bill viewed by WCBU totals almost $5,000. It was also sent by a collections agency, which city officials tell WCBU is an automatic process.
Colin Shope with that report. Hudson had been advised to reach out to Peoria's legal department and explore options to get the situation resolved 2 years after an accident that was not her fault. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And don't forget to join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.